On Minnesota Public Radio, I'm Gary Eichten. Glad you could join us. Well, today we are focusing on the DFL contest for the U.S. Senate. In 1 month, actually a month from tomorrow, voters will decide which DFLer will move on to the November general election against incumbent Republican Rod Grams. Now, there are four major candidates to choose from: former state auditor Mark Dayton, business executive Rebecca Yanish, trial attorney Michael Cerisi, and state senator Jerry Janicich. All four have come by our studios today to talk about the issues, try to win your support, and later this hour to take some of your questions as well. So thanks for joining us. A reminder that if you want to watch the candidates in action, we're webcasting this discussion live on our website, minnesotapublicradio.org. We're also conducting a forum online, so you can make some comments as the discussion goes along. To begin this hour, we're going to ask each of the candidates to explain in 2 minutes or less why they are the best Democrat in the field, why they should get your vote if you're going to vote in the Democratic primary in September, why they should get your vote. So let's go around the table. I believe we left off with Mark Dayton. 2 minutes or less, why are you the best man for the job?
Ultimately, Gary, that's the decision the voters get to decide, which is the great thing about our democracy. And I say that we have our disagreements around this table, but we have a really, I'm proud to be part of this group of candidates. I think the major difference between me and the others is between 15 and 30 years of experience in and commitment to public service. I mean, that's been my entire career, starting as a public school teacher in New York City back in 1969, right out of college, and as a social worker, street worker for Boston Social Service Agency, and then the last 25 years in government service on behalf of the people of Minnesota, except when the people of Minnesota declined my services. I've headed three different state agencies, economic development, energy and economic development, state auditor. I know the state. I've traveled this state for 25 years, That matters only if I can demonstrate that that results in a better understanding of the policies and the initiatives that could take place in Washington and in the Senate to benefit people today and in the future. One of the major differences, not 2 minutes?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, Gary's got, he's got the clock on. Okay, I'll stop there.
Well, just wrap. Lunch just wrap.
My father says time flies when you're having fun and even when you're not.
Jerry Janicich, a couple of minutes on why you're the best Democrat.
Well, Gary, first, I'm the DFL-endorsed Democrat, and I think that is pretty important. I've appealed to at least a base of my party. The other part of this, and I think is very important, is that the income gap has grown from 40-1 to 400-1 between the haves and the have-nots, and it's based on who's doing public policy in our country. And currently in the U.S. Senate, there's 85 of some of the wealthiest people out of 100, and I don't believe that that represents Minnesota. There aren't any electricians, plumbers, secretaries, or waitresses, and there certainly isn't anybody like me there. We need people in them rooms and in them halls who are like the rest of us in Minnesota and in this country. It should be about a mixture of incomes. There should be low to moderate middle-income people in those buildings. And I don't think it reflects us, and I don't think it's reflecting public policy. We need an advocate, somebody who sends their kids to private or to public schools, somebody who pays house payments, makes car payments, and knows that $250, $300 at the end of August for school clothes is a big deal. Somebody who's scratching every time they're out and about to try to raise $25 to run in a campaign. I think those are kinds of things that we in Minnesota and in this country have to start paying attention to. Otherwise, our country is going to get away from us.
Rebecca Yanish, why are you the best DFLer in the field?
Well, Gary, I think the candidates sitting here would certainly all agree that we'd each bring a better vote than the vote of Rod Grams in the U.S. Senate right now. But it has to be more than just a vote. It needs to be a voice for people of Minnesota. And the voice I bring is from my experiences as, you know, someone who worked my way through college as a single mother, knowing how education transformed my life. That gives me a voice on the U.S. Senate floor to advocate for increasing Pell Grants, for increasing college opportunities for young people, and also to invest in our schools through special education and Head Start. When I talk about health care issues, again, it comes from the perspective of not having the benefit of health insurance at a crucial time in my life. So that voice will help me advocate for insurance coverage for all children and for prescription cost insurance for our senior citizens. When I talk about affordable housing or the quality of life in our community, it's from a professional perspective of over 22 years in working through with communities throughout the state of Minnesota, understanding their needs as they try to make their areas better places to live and work. So the experiences I've had have been shared by many Minnesotans, and I think that's important to point out, but it's not experiences that are reflected in the United States Senate right now. So I want to bring the voice of all Minnesotans to the U.S. Senate to be a more effective advocate on these important issues.
Michael Cerisi, why are you the best DFLer in the field?
I believe Minnesotans want a doer, somebody who has provided demonstrated leadership over a long period of time, who has leveled the playing field for people and who has done it with commitment and passion. You know, I'm the grandson of an immigrant. I worked my way through college and law school, and for 30 years, almost 30 years, I have taken on the causes of ordinary working men and women. We want to talk about women? I took on the IUD cases, Dale Kine, Shield Copper 7, took on the major drug companies in this country, and we beat them back when they said they were going to squash us like a bug. We got something done. We got defective products off the market. Take the cigarette case. Everybody said you were foolish to take that case, Mike. You're going to bury yourself and the law firm. We took it on, an industry that had never been beaten. It's the most powerful industry in this nation, and we set a national and international standard as we did in the IUD cases. That's what Minnesotans want, someone with passion, commitment, ability, the ability to assimilate large catalogs of information and get through it and then coalesce and bring people together and lead, not followers. Minnesota has a history in the Senate of leaders, not followers. That's what we want from the state, and I will bring that. From a business standpoint, I've run a business of 550 people. I know what it is to make sure that those folks have good pensions, good wages, good health care, and I know how to meet a budget. So I believe that I will attract both independents and moderate Republicans. I am the candidate who can beat Rod Grams, and I will beat Rod Grams. And so I ask everybody to come out in the September 12th primary, and please consider me for their support. That's not to say that the other Democrats at this table are not good people. As Rebecca said, they'll all be a better vote, but it's not a vote. It's an effective vote and effective leadership.
Okay, let's move on to our next issue here. And again, a reminder, those of you listening, you'll have a chance to call in with your questions here in a little while. But we've been talking a lot about domestic issues, politics, and the rest. Let's turn briefly here anyway to foreign affairs. That's a big part of being a senator. And I guess we left off with Senator Janicich. You'd be next here. It is possible next month, on the 13th of September, that the Palestinians will unilaterally declare that they're setting up an independent state in the Middle East. What should the U.S. response to that be?
I think that Gary, that we're doing the best we can, I think, by trying to make sure that Israel and Palestine are in the room discussing. And I think that anything that happens there has to be because of the negotiations and their work to get to some sort of conclusions on any of the issues there. And I think that the best thing we can possibly do is continue to be a cheerleader, continue to want to put them in the room, continue to want to see them work through their problems.
Anybody else care to comment? Or Rebecca Yanish?
Well, I think we've served a role as even stronger than a cheerleader in Camp David. One of the issues that many look to the United States for is the resources to enforce a long-term peace among those nations. I think it's very important when you look at the Palestinian state to acknowledge, of course, the humanitarian need in terms of the refugees on both sides of the issue there. And the United States needs to be part of that solution, too, when the discussions continue. It's very disappointing that the talks broke down in Camp David, but I do think that in many points there were progress made. Obviously, Jerusalem was the biggest sticking point, but I just encourage again that we continue actively lending support as we try to find peaceful solutions, because that's crucial for our entire world.
Mark Gayton?
First of all, this has been an intractable region of the world for over 2,000 years, so the progress and even setbacks have to be measured in relative terms. When there's not a war going on there, that's relative progress. Having been to Israel and to the Arab countries around them, you have to remember that setting up an independent Palestinian state would be akin in the geography to St. Paul, the forsworn enemy of Minneapolis, setting itself up as an independent nation. That's the distance between these countries in that region. And the Palestinian refugees exist on the Gaza and on the West Bank because of Israel's victories in two wars that were meant by the Arab states and initiated by the Arab states to wipe out the state of Israel. So you have to keep that perspective. Setting up an independent state on the border of Israel would be a grave threat to that country, and I think it would be seen as intolerable and should be treated as such. The United States has to continue to play a peacemaker role, for sure, but that's to prevent the extremists from taking over and really upsetting into a major conflagration.
Michael Cerisi?
The Palestinian state issue is part of the broader Mideast issue, including Syria. I think we have to remember that it's not just resettlement, and it's not just security, it's also water for Israel. These are all major security issues for them. We have had a special relationship with Israel. We should continue that because it sends a consistent message to the negotiators. We have to keep in mind what's going on internally in each country with their own political discourse and the age of Arafat and what he wants to accomplish over the long term before he passes from this earth. So I think what we need to do is have a consistent policy, knowing that America is going to have to provide substantial resources with respect to the security of Israel, so that the rest of the Arab world understands that and knows that they must sit down at the table and negotiate in good faith. And we need to be an honest broker in that regard, and I think we've done that. That's why I believe we've made the progress we have to this time. These problems seem to be intractable because they go back centuries. But we've seen tremendous progress. At the last peace discussions, there was tremendous progress. Apparently, and none of us have all the facts on this, but apparently Israel moved much more than Palestine did. And I think it's right for us to continue to provide that strong support for Israel.
Rebecca Yanish, we've seen big protests in Seattle, Washington over globalization. There were protests here in Minneapolis over animal genetics research, corporate influence, and the rest. The protests in Philadelphia, where the Republicans have been meeting, there'll be protests in Los Angeles. In each case, they seem to be somewhat related. At least that's how the news coverage would portray them to be. What do you suppose is at the heart of all this discontent or apparent discontent?
Well, I think the trigger certainly in Seattle was a very real concern for labor standards, humanitarian standards, and environmental standards as part of the World Trade Organization. And I think those are very valid discussions. I would just hope, though, that people participating in those expressions of concern are truly there because of that agenda and not other agendas. And I know Jerry was certainly there in Seattle and there for all the right reasons. But what I'm concerned about as a resident of Minneapolis and downtown Minneapolis, certainly, first of all, I really want to compliment our police force here in the city of Minneapolis and the other police officers that helped out in that instance, because I think they really did a great job in protecting the businesses and the residents and the citizens of our city that wanted to really, you know, carry on their normal life in a difficult situation. So there needs to be a balance here between truly advocating in a thoughtful way on tough issues and really disrupting conversations that need to be done more on a more civil basis.
Mark Dayton?
The issue here is not between free trade and fair trade, both of which are euphemisms and myths. It's between profits and capital, again, over workers and wages. And that's what the so-called free trade movement in this world over the last 10, 20 years has been fundamentally about. It's about shifting higher paying, more unionized pension and health care benefit, providing jobs for Americans and Minnesotans, and sending those abroad to Southeast Asia, to China, to Korea to Mexico, where they can pay people cents versus dollars, where they can avoid any of the environmental and pension and health and worker safety. And it's just been missold fundamentally across the board. It's meant that in northeastern Minnesota, 1,400 people and their families are going to be out of work if we can't reverse that because LTV Corporation is shutting down. It's meant, and the farmers are being, I think, misled drastically. It's meant now we have cash corn prices in greater Minnesota of $1.25 for corn. It's $1.85 when I ran 18 years ago for the Senate. And it's because the floor has come off so that the big grain companies can make their profits moving that grain around the world. We're just terribly, and I think our government is seriously at fault, you know, in a bipartisan way, misleading the people at what's at stake here. It's wages and workers being sacrificed for profits, corporate profits, and the success of capital.
Michael Cerisi?
Well, Gary, you ask a sort of a question that a philosopher should probably answer, the source of discontent for all segments of our society. And I think it probably is at all segments. I think most people feel that the world is moving so fast. There are so many things happening that it's very difficult to feel you can have a meaningful impact in any policies that are affecting your daily life. I think that's sort of at the root cause of a lot of the discontent. And Jerry was in Seattle, and he always reminds us of that. But then I'm quick to point out to him that Rebecca and I were at the farm rally in Washington, and I didn't see Jerry there because he had other obligations, just as we did during the Seattle event. So I think that this raises the issue of what I've addressed with the Family Security Act. We need lifelong education. Mark talked about jobs moving out of the country. It used to be, you'll recall, we had the Rust Belt and jobs moving from the northern tier of the country down to the southern tier of the country because they were non-unionized jobs, always going toward cheaper labor. And that is an issue. But we need lifelong education so that our workers have an ability to have the skills to compete in what is going to continually be a global economy. That's a fact. So you either embrace that and figure out how you get the skills to your citizens so that they can compete and compete effectively, or you sort of hunker down. I'm in favor of taking a proactive viewpoint and saying, how do we get lifelong education? The World Trade Organization, you know, as Democrats, I believe, and I think this is where I differ from at least two of the candidates here, I believe that we should, as long as the Levin B. Reiter Amendment is attached in the Senate, vote for PNTR. I think our policy of opposing that as a party, or many in the party opposing it, is misplaced because we don't want to isolate China. Where I think we ought to be focusing our energy is on the World Trade Organization. We need to open that up because that agency is now, through bureaucrats who we don't know, experts who we don't know, able to change our labor and environmental laws in this country by calling them unfair trade practices. That process needs to be opened up. It needs to be transparent. There has to be participation by the affected groups within this nation and other nations so that those issues move forward. That's another thing we can do. That then gets people involved, and they feel that there's a voice in participation. And to use an analogy, it's like when the government just took away many snowmobile trails in the parks, and they just announced it. Now, the result may have been appropriate, but why wasn't there open hearings so people could participate in it and they could have had a voice? That is part, I think, that's at the root of the discontent that we're seeing. Things are moving so fast, and people do not feel they have an effective voice. And that's, again, why I think they want leadership in the United States Senate. They want someone who has provided leadership and will tackle these projects and go after them and get things done.
They're going to like me.
Jerry,
and as I said before,
gonna
like Jerry, me. They're going to like me better. Okay.
They're going to like me in the
Jerry Janicich, did you want to comment on this?
Well, of course. I was in Seattle, and I believe I did go for all the right reasons. I think it's about our quality of life, not only in Minnesota but in America. Our labor unions, our environmental community, our young people, and our farmers were always in this country's history our social conscience. And for the first time in a very long time, they got together and said, something's not right here. It doesn't work. And I've actually been experiencing that in northern Minnesota, like Mark referenced, for a long time. In our country today and in our state, there have been two things in the world economy for a long time: steel and agriculture. And what is the price of corn? What is the price of steel? What's going to happen to those 1,400 people in northern Minnesota and their families? If those 1,400 people don't work, the quality of their life diminishes, the quality of the business people in that area diminishes, that school doesn't stay open. Those are the kinds of things that I've been working on in the legislature for a long time, and I wasn't in Washington because that's where I was. I was in the Minnesota legislature. I was doing what I was elected to do, represent working men and women and people and try to get them to have the best break they could have in how this all works. In a world economy, we have choices, I believe. My dad went on strike, and my mom and every working family struggled so that we could have 40-hour work weeks, so we could have vacation, so we could have benefits, and we have a quality of life second to none, not only in the state but in this nation. We can't afford to have somebody take that away from us. And that will happen unless we engage other parts of our country and bring them to our level. And I don't see us doing that. All I see us doing is saying, let's go. And we can't do that. And I was happy and glad that the farmers and the environmental community and our young people in labor said, hey, enough is enough. Because that's what has to happen in this country, obviously, to get anybody's attention.
We're getting close to news time here, but can I ask each of you, not a real personal question, but a semi-personal question before we take a break here?
Well, what is it first?
Yeah, you can ask it, Gary, yeah, but I'm not sure we're all going to answer it.
Well, you know, people don't really get a chance to find out much about you folks personally during these campaigns, stands on the issues and so on, but I'm just curious, if you weren't campaigning, if you weren't running for office, if you didn't have to go to work, what would you do over the weekend? What do you do in your free time? What do you like to do?
That's an easy one.
Jerry Janicich, what?
Well, first I would have to work a little bit because of being in the bar, the small business. I would bartend a little bit, and then I would get out on the pontoon and ride around on the lake. put the fishing line out. And if you caught a fish, fine. Usually you don't want to catch a fish because that means you got to take it off and clean it and do all those other kinds of things. But that's what I would like to do with Patty and the kids.
Yeah. I would be at our lake place, too, with my four grandchildren, certainly playing in the lake and riding on the boat and enjoying their time in this beautiful summer.
Mark Dayton?
Go the same route. I have two boys who are 20 and almost 17. My older one's just back from college. He'll be leaving a couple weeks to go back. So I would track them down. They're delighted I'm campaigning because it means I'm not trying to track them down, strong arm them into going to a movie or something like that. But that's what I'd be trying to do.
Uh-huh. Michael Cerisi?
Well, you know, I'm pretty used to working these types of hours, but if I didn't have to, I'd be spending more time. Ann and I have between us three children and five grandchildren. We spend a lot of time with them. That's why the two boys are working with us on the campaign here, so it gives me a lot of time with them. But I'd try. You know, I was down at in Jackson, Minnesota last night with the Corn Growers Association. They had their golf day. It was about 500 of them, and I asked them all as they were coming off the course, how'd you hit them? They said, well, we had a great time. Because, you know, they're working hard. They don't get to play a lot of golf. I like golf. I don't get to play a lot, but I'd be out in the golf course once in a while.
I can't golf. Trying
to improve. Well, yeah, well, see, some of us are athletes. Some of us are athletes, Jerry,
jog,
you know. But Jerry, some of us are athletes. Jog. Everybody can jog.
Oh, the frustration of hitting a golf ball.
Quick comment, Mark.
Jealous that you have your kids out campaigning with you there, Mike. I tried to get my sons years ago in the running for auditor to come to hear me speak once, and my then 7-year-old, the younger son, Andrew, looked at me and said, Dad, I went to hear you speak once before, and you were really boring. And I haven't summoned the courage to ask him to come with me since. Well, but, I was watching your commercial. Your son, Adam, he's the next generation of super political stars in Minnesota.
He's a great, great young man. Mark, I'm not going to touch that with a 10-foot pole. The fact that they said you were boring, I would never accuse you of that, Mark.
I had my youngest one with us the other day in Mankato, and we got the last room at the hotel, and so we needed a rollaway bed, right? And he's about 6'1", 6'2", probably. So he's in this rollaway bed, and his legs are sticking out, you know. He's got the blanket up to his neck, and his legs are sticking out probably from the knee down, and I'm walking by him, and he says to me, he says, Dad, so look at this. And I started giggling. And I said, think of it as the glass is half full. And he said, how could I do that? I said, 20 years from now, you'll be sitting around the table with my grandsons, my grandchildren. I said, you can tell them how your dad got crazy enough to think you could become a U.S. senator, and you were in a hotel room with a blanket pulled up to your neck and your knees down, sticking out of the thing.
Yeah, at my height, Jerry, I never have that
you
problem.
For the most part, don't have that problem either.
But you're listening to a special edition of Midday on Minnesota Public Radio. I might add, by the way, that I'm sorely disappointed that none of you would choose in your free time to listen to public discussions here on Minnesota Public.
Well, didn't we mention that, Gary?
We're talking with all four of the major DFL candidates for the U.S. Senate nomination. The election is September 12th, just a month away, and we're going to break for some news headlines. Then when we come back, we'd like to add some of your questions to the mix. So give us a call if you have a question for the candidate, 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000. If you're calling from outside the Twin Cities, 1-800-242-2828. Stephen Judd is standing by now with some news headlines. Stephen?
All right, Gary. Air safety officials have released hundreds of pages of files from the Egypt Air crash, but they aren't ready to announce a cause. Nothing in the documents, however, contradicts official suggestions that a co-pilot may have deliberately plunged the plane into the sea. An Egyptian investigator says officials in his country are upset with that speculation. Democrat Al Gore is seeking to boost support from union workers at stops in Philadelphia and Michigan today. Gore is getting the endorsement of the United Auto Workers despite labor opposition to Gore's views on trade issues. Stock prices are mixed once again today on Wall Street. Blue chip stocks are higher after some encouraging economic data, but technology shares are falling on continued fears of a second half earnings slowdown. Minnesota companies drew a record $246.5 million in venture capital investments in the second quarter, a gain of $9 million over the first quarter. But the 3.8% quarter-to-quarter gain was well below the nationwide 14% increase in venture funding. A 21-year-old Minneapolis man faces sentencing September 21st for threatening to shoot a community college student who wouldn't buy his rap compact disc and then threatening to shoot a security guard. Tyrone Pearson was found guilty of two counts of second-degree assault and one count of committing a crime while wearing a bulletproof vest. City leaders and landlords in Winona are working on a proposed ordinance that would allow only one keg of beer at a time in a home. The proposal is aimed at limiting the number of people at parties, especially the large keggers popular with college students. A partly cloudy, warm, humid day across the region today. There's a chance of thunderstorms in the north. The highs should range from around 90 degrees to near 100 in the northwest. For the Twin Cities, mostly sunny, warm, and humid. Southwest winds at 10 to 20 miles an hour. The high will be around 90 degrees. In Duluth, it's 74. Rochester, 79 degrees, 82 degrees in the Twin Cities. I'm Stephen John. That's news from Minnesota Public Radio.
All right. Thank you, Stephen. It's about 26 minutes before 1. This is Midday on Minnesota Public Radio. Today, featuring all of the major DFL candidates for the U.S. Senate nomination. A month from now, somewhat survivor style, all but one of these candidates is going to be voted off the ballot. The winner of the primary will move on to the November general election against incumbent Republican Rod Grams. Today, the candidates have come by to talk about the issues, try to win your support, and take your questions. So again, if you have a question, give us a call, 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. And a reminder, if you'd like to watch this discussion, we are webcasting the discussion. I guess that's the official word. Log on to the website, minnesotapublicradio.org. You can see the candidates in action, and we have a forum underway as well, so you can make your comments. And lots of callers are already on the line. Bruce, your question for the candidates, please.
Okay, thank you. Our national infrastructure has fallen victim to opportunistic and short-sighted tax cuts, in addition to deregulation and privatization. How will you argue against horrible neglect of and the funding cuts versus tax cut fever?
Michael Cerisi, I think we left off with you.
Okay. Bruce, what I have said from the day I got into this campaign is that the overarching issue, I believe, in this campaign, and it really encompasses the issues of privatization and the neglect of our infrastructure, is this. Are we going to follow the path of self-interest, which is what the Republicans have been preaching through tax cuts, which predominantly go to the wealthiest in this nation? Or are we going to follow the path of the common good? And I suggest that in this nation, when we've done best as a people and as a nation, we have followed the common good by investing in each other. And I will give you one vivid example. I was speaking to a bunch of moderate Republicans in Rochester who are supporting me, and they have been frightened to death of Democrats because they think they're tax and spend. And I started describing a bill that would pay for college education and maybe even give you a stipend while you were there, a bill that would give you a low-interest mortgage on your first home, a bill that would help you start a small business with a low-interest loan. Their eyes got wider and wider, and then I said, that was the GI Bill, a bill that Rod Grams would vote against, a bill that built the middle class in this country. We need to reinvest in each other, and I, as your advocate in Washington, will passionately, consistently articulate a vision for America that says we ought to seize this opportunity and invest in each other to give each other the opportunity to succeed. Not a handout, but the opportunity to succeed. That's what we must do, and we need that type of leadership in Washington today.
Rebecca Yanish?
Well, Bruce, you know, I'm really glad you brought that question up because it really does get to a real core fundamental issue here. And too often right now the rhetoric is, give me my money back, rather than looking at our nation as a whole and where our investments need to be. This is an issue of values and priorities. When I talked earlier about education transforming my life, you know, certainly that's an investment that is part of our infrastructure in the sense that a skilled workforce is the key ingredient to future economic health in our nation. And when we look at short-sighted issues of tax cuts versus increase in Pell Grants, well, my goodness, here's a program that serves 4 million aspiring young people each year. The average family income for those receiving Pell Grants is less than $20,000 a year. When Senator Grams voted against increasing Pell Grants on April 7th, he was voting against one of the most fundamental tools we have to keep building that skilled workforce and to give people hope for the future. So I think what we need to do, Bruce, is we need to bring this conversation down to a very personal level to say, isn't this what we should be caring about? You know, isn't this how we should be setting our priorities and investing in our nation and our future?
Mark Gayton.
Bruce, I'd like to address this from the perspective of our physical infrastructure because I think it's an excellent question we don't get much about. You know, government is so focused on the next budget, the next election, and the problem is these capital expenditures and investments in our roads, bridges, highways, airports are only going to pay off 10 to 20 years down the road. I think that the president and the Congress, the president ought to, as a separate address, at least every 2 years, as is done in Minnesota with the capital bonding bill, address the policies that he or she is proposing in that area and define them in that 10 to 20 year realm. What are the policies? What are the funding sources? And what improvements are we going to see in 10 or 20 years? We have a traffic nightmare in the metropolitan area in Minneapolis or St. Paul region. Outstate Minnesota, the roads are declining in quality. The federal government is nowhere in that practice. The airport noise problem, which with an airport that's now operating 24 hours day and night, has been largely unaddressed. So your question is an excellent one. And again, state and local governments can do a lot. The state of Minnesota needs to do a lot more. But the bottom line is the federal government has both the dollars and also the financing capability through long-term investments. And if it opts out, we're going to see that decay increasing.
Jerry Janicich.
Yes, Bruce, I'm the DFL-endorsed candidate for the U.S. Senate, and I'm proud of that. And I'm proud of that because of what it means. My politics have always been the politics of people. In the legislature in the early 90s when carrying a program for breakfast for our children was an unpopular thing to do, I understood that there were a lot of kids going to school every day not eating. Today, it's a $15 million appropriation, and almost every child in our state has access. Head Start, one of the neatest things that the federal government probably has done for our children in a long time, I helped make a bigger deal in Minnesota. In the legislature, I was a leader in creating the Department of Early Childhood. Part of what we need to do is have a vision of where we want to go in this country. Currently, there are a ton of kids being left behind. I've been to public schools and saw when they go by that food line and they grab that extra roll for their treat. In the federal government, we need to invest in our children. We need a U.S. senator who's going to talk about birth to seven being the most important time in a child's life and making it happen. In this day and age, we leave our kids off at infant care and daycare. And our most valuable resource, our children, are we giving them what they need at those at infant care and daycare? We need to redirect resources to do all those kinds of things. If we do this right, that human infrastructure, which we, for some odd reason, put such little value on, will ultimately nourish and grow, and we won't spend the kinds of money we spent in Minnesota over the last 5 or 6 years building prisons and juvenile centers. We'll invest it in technology, we'll invest it in books, and we'll invest it in higher education opportunities.
Governor Ventura argues that too often we turn our attention to the government to solve some of these problems, that many of the problems, for example, with smaller children are best dealt with, frankly, by parents, and that the government has a very limited role to play here. How would you respond to that, Rebecca Yanish?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up and looking at the roles here. And I, just last week was out at the Jeremiah program in Minneapolis, which is a program. It's 18 units of housing for mothers with young children. And I'm on the board of Jeremiah because I believe so strongly in giving people the tools they need to succeed. So on site there is a daycare program. The young mothers there are in education programs, and they're also working. Jeremiah was built through donations, through corporate donations and foundation donations, but it can only operate if the federal government is there as a partner to help with those Pell grants or education grants with the assistance these young women need to get to economic self-sufficiency. So I think that's a perfect example, again, of how people want to work towards their, take personal responsibility for the success in the future, but can only do that if there's a good partnership giving them the tools they need to succeed.
Jerry Janicich.
And Gary, Governor Ventura may say that, but I think sometimes he chooses the opposite. His administration helped me pass that breakfast bill this last time, the largest ever in our state's history. And I think that we have to understand in the economy where Minnesota leads the nation in women working, in an economy where Minnesota leads the nation in two people in a family working, that there's going to be some problems on the bottom side if we don't have the proper infant care and daycare, because that's where our children are. Or if we don't have the right, types of setups for when they come home from school. If we don't have opportunities for our kids to do, and if they're not created either through the school, which is government, or through the city, which is government, some of those kinds of things don't happen. And I think you have to balance where we're headed.
Michael Cerisi?
Well, I don't think anybody would disagree with the governor's proposition that parents have to have a strong and effective role in raising children. I mean, we all agree with that. The question is, how do you enable them to have that effective role when they are working to the degree that Jerry just mentioned? In America, people work harder than anywhere else in the Western world. I was with a legislator from Germany yesterday. Their tax rate runs from about 29 to about 43%. In addition, they have deductions for pensions, for health care, for unemployment insurance, and they get paid per child 270 marks up to 350 marks. Totally different system. I'm not suggesting that's a system we adopt in America, but the question goes back to Bruce's call a little bit ago, the last call I think we had. We need to take a look and see how we can fiscally and prudently invest in each other to enable each other to do these things. We have to have lifelong education. We need programs like the Abraham Lincoln School and the Higher Ground Academy. We need programs like Twin City Rise in Minneapolis, giving people the opportunity to have livable wages so that they can do these things that are needed to raise our children. And education, 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 it's the key. The absolute key for people moving up the economic ladder, and it's lifelong education from pre-K through age 65. If we do that, and folks who sort of argue with that and say, well, isn't that just a spend program? It's not. It's an investment program. If you have a child who's lagging behind in your family, you give that child a little extra time. That's investment. whether it's your time or you get a tutor for them. In business, you invest. We need to invest in the people of this nation. And it's, as I say, it's enlightened self-interest, if nothing else. If more people have the education to be productive and to live with dignity, we're all going to be better off. So that's what we need to do, and I think we'll start solving that problem.
Mark Dayton?
It's not an either-or proposition. It's both, and each with an appropriate role. The family is the source of early childhood nurturing, and if we had a better society and a better world, all of those children would be getting the kind of support and learning that they need. The reality, unpleasantly, is that it's not happening in greater proportions in this state and across this country. I met last week with Harold Johnson, the superintendent of schools for Minneapolis. 1/4 of the children who enter kindergarten in the Minneapolis public school system don't know their entire name. 2/3 of them can't recite and write the alphabet. Government has no choice but to step in when there are those kinds of breakdowns in basic parenting and pick up and try to make up that difference. The second part of it then is, what can government do to strengthen families, to help them succeed? Livable wage, absolutely. Government, I mean, to be talking about a minimum wage going from $5.15 to $6.15 an hour, we want to make work pay. I'm the only candidate among the four of us who's for providing health coverage for every single American, children and adults, through employer mandates, through the government self-insuring to pick up the rest. We've got to provide health care, quality care, or we pay the price down the road. Child care tax credit, as I said before, expanding that so that working families can afford to have their children in nurturing environments when they have to work. There's a huge role for government that isn't about how families or parents raise their children. It's about helping parents to be better parents and their children to grow up in healthier environments.
Michael Cerisi?
Well, Mark, I think all of us have addressed the health care issue. In fact,
we've addressed it, Mike, but you don't have a proposal. If you're against employer mandates and you're not for a single payer, so what are you for that's going to provide tomorrow insurance for coverage for every American?
Are you done now? Can I finish?
Yeah, no, that's the question.
All right, let me finish. Last time, you wanted universally in one step to mandate health care. Your latest ad backs away from that. I have said consistently that we should use tax credits. Number one, the greatest increasing group that does not have insurance are those workers age 55 and over. I said they should be able to buy into Medicare, and they should get a tax cut for it. COBRA, you should be able to get a 25% tax credit on COBRA. I've said that the CHIPS programs for children should be extended. And I've said that about 75% of the people who are uninsured are in small businesses, and we should have tax credits for small businesses to be able to get health care insurance. Now, it is not in one fell swoop, but I've laid out a very specific plan. You have said one thing, and then in your last ad, you went back and said it should be incremental. Now, we can argue about which way you go about it, but the fact is, I think we all agree that we should have health insurance. I think everybody at this table has said that.
Well, I'll be very clear. This is Mark Dayton, Gary, because my ad was cut, and you're right, and Bill Salisbury caught that very appropriately today. My position, emphatically, George Bush is for tax credits for people to buy health insurance. How many people making the kind of wages that the employees for the Target or the Walmart or the health or the hospitality industry can afford those tax credits? I'm for requiring employers to provide health insurance, full-time prorated for part-time, assisting small businesses in doing so, absolutely. I'm for a federal program that's comprehensive, that picks for everyone else, and that's fundamentally different. That is one step. You're right, but you're trying to piecemeal
Mark,
approach.
Mark, 75% of
Jerry Janus. Jerry Janus.
I've been wondering how I was ever going to get a TV ad on with a little bit of money I've got. I'm kind of glad I don't have any ads out there, if that's the kind of trouble you get in when you run an ad.
Well, but 75% of the people, and Mark, this is not trouble. This is discussing policy, and I think and that's what we should do. 75% of the people who aren't insured are in small businesses. Now, you say you're going to mandate
that. That's
them.
You're inaccurate,
Ask Jerry Janicek what it's like to run a small business and be able to afford health insurance. You have to give them some incentive to be able to do that.
Mike,
that's the key. That's the key.
Rebecca Yanish.
Well, I just want to inject here that I have consistently said one of our first steps has to be ensuring our children and has to be ensuring that our senior citizens aren't gouged by these awful prescription price costs. But in that process, too, I find it's really interesting that, you know, the state of Minnesota has really actually done a fabulous job over the years in trying to insure children. And we are being penalized right now because of the success we've had. There's $28 million from the federal government that we're at risk of losing that could reach out to another 48,000 children in our state that are uninsured. Paul Wellstone has co-sponsored a bill to ensure that we continue having the time frame to reach those children, which is a tough thing to do. Senator Grams has not co-sponsored that bill. That's a very fundamental issue. When we talk about where our values are, where our priorities are, my priority is getting those kids covered because, you know, a doctor's visit today for a youngster with a health problem will pay off many times in the future, and that's the population we have to be concerned about.
Mark Dayton.
First of all, Mike, your statistic is incorrect. 75% of the people who do not have health insurance in this country are working, but
for small businesses.
No. Well, look it up. Most of them work for larger employers because the Targets, the Walmarts, and the like don't provide health insurance, and they can afford it, and they can't. Small businesses, very small ones, that can't. Yes, okay. Help them do so. And I would a fundamental difference, Rebecca, between us mm-hmm. is. You talk about growing up as a single mother without health insurance, but your proposals don't provide health insurance for single mothers. They provide them for the children. Al Gore, George Bush are providing health insurance for children. I'm talking about insuring and providing health coverage for every American of any age.
All right, Jerry Janisich is next.
And that's another one that if we just broadened Medicare, we could probably do almost everything. Medicare, we have a system of providers. We have a system of rate regulation. If we broaden it to universally, we can get this thing done in a lot quicker way than the whole debate. This is another one of those things that in 1960, John Kennedy talked about it in his convention speech in 1960. He talked about universal health care. And you have to wonder why we're not there. I mean, it just seems to me that we got the wrong people in Washington. There aren't any people there that are struggling with their health care.
Okay.
Everybody there has it.
Quick comments here. Then I want to get to one more caller, Michael Cerisi. Quick comment.
Well, you have to look at where the resources are and where you're going to dedicate them. I just talked about what Germany has, and you know, Mark, you mentioned Target. You got a better inroad into them than any of us. Maybe you could tell them to insure those folks. But the fact is, if you look at small businesses, they have a very difficult time insuring people. And we have to give them an ability to do it. And you can ask Jerry Janicek about that. He operates a small bar in northern Minnesota. You don't provide health care, you can't.
No, you can't.
Take a look at it.
Okay, and Rebecca Yanish, a quick comment on this subject before we go to our last caller.
Okay, and thanks, Mark, for pointing out. You know, I have lived through the struggles that many people are facing right now. And, yes, I do want to get to the point where every single young mother wouldn't have to go through the pain I went through. But I think we have to set priorities here, and I think it is a matter of leadership, and I can assure you that when I stand on the floor of the U.S. Senate and bring the voice of advocacy for better health care coverage, it won't be from looking at polls or briefing books. It will be speaking from the heart and from my own experiences, and that's the difference that I bring to this race.
Don, a quick question here before we wrap up.
Yes. So many important issues that you've talked about and need to be addressed in Washington. And we see and hear all the partisan fighting. It's almost like a game's being played there. Why do you believe you can improve the culture there so that Republicans and Democrats can work together to solve the problems we face?
Okay, why don't I give each of you a minute to address that, and then we'll be out of time. Let's see. Jerry Janisich, you want to go first?
Don, because I've been working in that culture for a long time. I've been in the Minnesota Senate. I've been in the Minnesota House. I've been working on putting together coalitions to get some things done. Back in 92, 93, my Republican colleagues thought that a breakfast program was a crazy idea. This past year, there wasn't anybody who voted against it. That's the kinds of things I've been doing. About putting together a coalition on housing, that's how we got it done. There wasn't one vote against the housing bill, I think. I've been doing those kinds of things in the Minnesota legislature and in the Minnesota Senate for a long time. And part of it is you can't teach getting along with people. You can't teach putting them in a room. That's okay. Just a natural ability.
Rebecca Yanish?
Don, that's an excellent question, and I believe I can improve the culture by bringing a different voice to the conversation here. And it is a voice of accomplishment in terms of looking at the work through the city of Minneapolis and in many communities across our state. It's not only looking at the public policies, but looking at being in the trenches to solve some of the tough issues. In Minneapolis, we know there's many strong voices out there, many different interests, and I've been able to bring those interests together to work forward to keep 15,000 jobs within our city, to develop 4,000 units of affordable housing. So it's a track record of accomplishments from bringing a very collaborative approach to listening to the voices, finding solutions, and moving forward.
Michael Cerisi?
Well, number one, being a trial lawyer, 90% of all cases are resolved, and they're resolved through bringing people together on very difficult, intractable issues and getting them done. I have a record of accomplishment of setting national and international standards as a leader, a record of leadership. That's what I will bring to the United States Senate. I think that's different than any of the other good Democratic candidates that are here. When health care for women was at stake, I did things for women. I took it on under very difficult and trying circumstances and got it done. On the cigarette case, when people said this cannot be done, we took it on and set a national standard. That's the type of effective, competent leadership that Minnesotans want, and it comes from bringing people together from all walks of life and getting the job done. Minnesotans want a doer, and that's what I am.
Mark Dayton?
Don, I certainly agree that compromise is a necessary part of being effective in government, and I've been a part of that over 25 years. But I disagree with the diagnosis that that's the critical failing out there. In a democracy, these ideas are differences of views among the four of us with the Republican opponent. That's the essence of how we govern a country. It's not with guns or political power or a kind of fascist control. It's that kind of debate. And I think the differences between ourselves and Rod Graham's are profound, between Democrats and Republicans. I think those differences are blurred too often because the voice of people is not being represented. That's why Governor Ventura successfully was elected. So I say, choose somebody who's going to go out there and fiercely advocate, fight for what you believe is in the best interest of this country, and encourage them to do so, because that's how we get things done.
Well, folks, I'd like to thank you for coming in today. We're pretty much out of time.
Thank you, Gary.
Now, on this free, what you're going to do with your free time, the correct answer would be?
We're going to listen to NPR discuss political issues.
Deep, heavy public policy.
Deep, heavy public policy. And we'll be here, Gary.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Our guests today, the four major DFL candidates for the U.S. Senate nomination, State Senator Jerry Janicich, trial attorney Michael Cerisi, business executive Rebecca Yanish, and former state auditor Mark Dayton. I'd like to thank the candidates for coming in. I'd like to thank all of you who've been with us through the program. Now, a reminder again, the primary election is September 12th, a month from now. Whoever wins the primary moves on to the November general election against incumbent Republican Rod Grams. Sarah Meyer produced our program today. Kara Figenshu is our assistant producer, and our engineer today was Alan Strickland. Now, a couple of other reminders. If you missed today's program, we'll be rebroadcasting the entire discussion and starting at 9 o'clock tonight. Also, it will be added, the program will be added to our ever-expanding online election coverage. So all you have to do there is log on and listen to today's discussion at your leisure. And our website address is minnesotapublicradio.org. That's it for today. Gary Eichten here. Again, thanks so much for tuning in to Midday Today, and join us on Monday.
Okay, it's time.
Friday
it's
night time at 11, now. Saturday afternoon at 2 on Minnesota
four,
Public Radio. Dale Connolly
three,
reporting, filling
two,
the airwaves with
one.
Preposterous lies.
There they go. Beautiful.
You're listening to Minnesota Public Radio. And we have a partly cloudy sky, 82 degrees at KNRW-FM, 91.1 Minneapolis and St. Paul. Sunny through the afternoon. Hot and humid with a high near 90, partly cloudy tonight with a low in the low 70s, warm and humid again tomorrow, 40% chance for a thunderstorm tomorrow with a high once again near 90. From National Public Radio in New York, this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Paul Rayburn. Public health experts call it the brown